coming up on this special edition of The Green from Delaware Public Media. Our Canada Conversation series continues with interviews from the 2020 race for the first state's lone seat in the U.S. House. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We hear from the Republicans in that race, Matthew Morris and Lee Murphy. Plus, an in-depth look at the Democratic primary in the race for the 8th district seat in the State House of Representatives. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As part of our 2020 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is offering a series of candidate conversations. We reached out to all candidates filed to run in the races for U.S. House and U.S. Senate, as well as governor, lieutenant governor, and insurance commissioner, and invited them to sit down with us. Candidates in each race are being asked about the same set of topics to allow you to get to know them and compare them. The interviews you'll hear here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. The race for U.S. House features four candidates challenging the incumbent, Democrat Lisa Blunt Rochester. Today, we feature the two Republicans in the race, Matthew Morris and Lee Murphy. Morris is running for public office for the first time.
So we'll start with, why did you decide to run for U.S. House?
So for the past 3 years, I have been advocating for substance use disorder treatment in the state of Delaware. And one of the things that I kept on hearing from our state legislators is that it's all about a matter of funding. Of course, where does the funding come from? It comes from our U.S. House representative who appropriates all the funds to our state.
And what should voters know about your qualifications for the job? Perhaps that they wouldn't know necessarily by looking at your website or doing a quick Google search of you.
Yeah, so one thing that I think that the voters need to take into consideration when voting for me is going to be that I am a very strong-minded person. I also have a strong background in business acumen, and I also have a very strong voice. I put the people's needs first, and I have a very strong rapport with the community already, and I also have a very strong resume with the community and all that I've accomplished already.
Are there a couple of things specifically that you look at on that resume that you think are specifically important for people to know about in terms of your qualifications to sit in Congress and serve in Congress?
Well, the one thing that that differs me from many other people is the fact that I'm not a career politician. I am just your average Joe. I don't have a background in politics aside from the community activism that I've been engaging in the past 3 years. But I have solid results, and I think that's all that really matters.
Okay. Let's talk about some issues, and we'll start with the current COVID-19 pandemic. And I guess my first question in that area is, how do you feel the federal government, specifically Congress, has done in responding to the pandemic? And if there's still no readily available vaccines or established treatments by the end of the year, what would you want Congress to prioritize in terms of dealing with the pandemic?
Well, first and foremost, I think that the most important thing is the overall general welfare and safety and health of our citizens. I think that Congress has done a tremendous job in appropriating funds to help people who were unemployed during the shutdown. However, I have strong feelings about the regulations that were kind of slid through the back door during the CARES Act, and I feel as though that was kind of a direct attack on Americans, and I feel as though that there's a time and place to put regulations into place and to present in certain bills, and I don't think that a bill that is made for helping Americans during a pandemic is the time to implement airline regulations and fuel regulations when Americans are struggling to find out how they're going to be able to pay their bills.
The other piece of this, the pandemic puzzle, is the economic piece. You talked a little bit about it in terms of the relief that was in some of those bills. But still, the country is in the midst of a recession with high unemployment because of this pandemic. What role do you think Congress can play in getting the economy back on track, especially if the pandemic continues to have an impact into 2021?
Yeah, so moving forward, we can't really focus on what has happened. We have to move forward in the situation. And I think that the most important thing is being able to support our small businesses. Being able to get people back on their feet and into the economy is one of the most important things. However, I do understand that there are going to be tremendous trickle-down effects from this pandemic. And, you know, I work for a company that's a multi-billion dollar company. We were losing hundreds of thousands of dollars a day simply because all of our stores had to be shut down. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this is all going to play out. I know that in the last economic crisis, we had to bail out a lot of companies. And I'm sure that that's going to be something that we're going to have to look into doing again. We need to make sure that we're putting Americans first and we're getting people back into the workforce.
Certainly, healthcare was a major issue in the last election cycle, the 2018 cycle, and there's still a lot of uncertainty about the future of the Affordable Care Act. At the same time, there is a growing push on the progressive side of the Democratic Party for some kind of what they would call Medicare for All.
Yeah.
What do you see as the appropriate path forward for addressing healthcare in this country? And if it's not the ACA or Medicare for All, what should it be?
So I stand firm in opening up the market for health insurance across state lines. I think that creating a competitive market is going to incentivize insurance companies to drop premium rates and be more a little bit competitive when it comes to rates and deductibles and providing great health care for individuals as well as their families. you know, I don't know if we have the capacity to be able to afford Medicare and Medicaid for all type of healthcare system. However, I believe that incentivizing it through a competitive market may be the best avenue to go.
Would you like to get rid of the Affordable Care Act as a whole, or would you be willing to, as some have suggested, work within that framework to do things differently?
So working with that framework to do things a little bit differently would be my avenue to take, absolutely. There are things that were in the Affordable Health Care Act that I believe helped Americans, especially with pre-existing conditions. Before, if, say, you were a patient who was at end of life, your insurance company could just cut you off and say, you know what, the last 5 months, you're just going to have to figure it out on your own. And I don't think that that's a compassionate way to be dealing with our citizens.
Let's move on to a topic that's also been front of the headlines recently, and that is the protests throughout the spring and summer on issues surrounding racial equality. The topics of debate on this have kind of run a pretty wide gamut, from getting rid of memorials and monuments and renaming sports teams to police reform and,
yeah,
and dealing with other disparities in terms of racial equity, things like housing, education,
yeah,
and things
absolutely
like that. So if you were elected, you know, what do you believe Congress's role would be in addressing some of these issues? What would you advocate for doing in Congress to address some of these issues?
Yeah, so when it comes to all of the events that have transpired over the past 3 months, when George Floyd, was murdered. you know, we saw a spike in the Black Lives Matter movement, and there are conflicting views on the entire movement versus the organization. And I think that we as a nation need to start focusing on the why. Why are we at this point? How did we get here? You know, I'm a firm believer, and I mean, the proof is in the pudding. What's going on in the city of Wilmington is a direct reflection of failed policies. I have been speaking with many advocates within the city limits of Wilmington, and we're all saying the same thing. You know, there's a mass incarceration legislation that was pushed through in the 80s. That has been a direct reflection of the Black community. I personally spent 2 years in prison. I saw systemic and institutional racism myself. I sat with many, 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 many men who had been incarcerated, who were given lengthy periods of of incarceration versus a white man who went before the same judge who had the same charges and was given less time. And I don't think that that's appropriate. And I understand that there are certain types of scales and weight systems for sentencing structures. And I think that being able to implement legislation that controls those sentencing structures with minimums and maximums is very, very important. But also, when it comes to policing, I think that defunding the police is not the answer. I don't know where that narrative came from, but I do think that community policing is very, very, very important. We need to get our police officers back into the community. We need them to be able to establish a relationship with our civilians. And the reason why is because when the relationship between civilians and law enforcement is mended, then there's more trust. If we have our officers out on the streets on foot instead of in patrol cars running around, you know, answering to calls or whatever, if we have our officers in the community, they're establishing a relationship with the community. And that's the most important part and missing piece to the puzzle in the trust in law enforcement. I think that we should vamp up our police funding. I think that we need to hire more police officers. I think that we need to have more police officers on the street. I think that our police officers are doing multiple jobs already. Look at Newcastle County police officers. Newcastle County police officers are not only doing the job of Newcastle County police, but they're also doing the jobs of Newcastle County paramedics and EMTs. They're administering naloxone and Narcan to more people than our actual EMTs and paramedics. That's an issue. And then when the Newcastle County police went to go ask for a raise, they were denied one. And then there was, of course, all those stipulations that followed with it. But, you know, this is a topic that it needs to be talked about. It's a very, very difficult topic for people to talk about because there has been police brutality. I myself have been a victim of police brutality. I have seen it firsthand, you know, and I think the resolution to that is that we need to be vigilant in reporting this police brutality. If we're not reporting it, it's going to keep on happening. It's going to keep on happening to the same people. It's going to keep on happening in our communities, and we need to put an end to it. And the only way to put an end to it is to bring light to the corruption.
I was going to say, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about are these issues that are happening on the local level with Wilmington Police, Newcastle County Police.
Absolutely.
And I've asked this of a number of people. Do you feel it is an issue that is best handled at the local level, or is there a role for Congress and the federal level to get involved as well?
Yeah, so the only answer to that question is funding. You know, being able to appropriate the funds to local levels, to our municipalities within the city limits or within our county limits, is very, very important. I was just having a conversation the other day with somebody, and I was saying, you know, with us not putting the proper funding and resources into prison reform, into our police departments, all we're doing is creating a cyclical process of us wasting money. You know, I'm a firm believer in harm reduction. When it comes to harm reduction, I explain it like this. If you have somebody who overdoses and they are taken to the hospital, how much money does that hospital visit cost? Are we talking about, are they being put into a medical-induced coma? Are they having to be put on life support? These are things that we really have to come into consideration. Does the person have health insurance? Now, who's paying for their hospital visit? We are. So why aren't we implementing a structure of harm reduction within our communities that in turn is going to save us money? I am a firm believer in working smarter and not harder. And these are things that we need to be talking about. I, you know, as a conservative, I believe in fiscal responsibility, and the way that we've been doing things is like we throw money at problems, but they're not smart business acumen decisions. I think that accountability is the number one thing that we need to be focusing on when it comes to criminality and antisocial behaviors, as well as addiction. I think that we need to be implementing a system on a local level and incentivizing it on a federal level where we are incentivizing accountability from the very beginning. If somebody's being administered naloxone or Narcan because of an opioid overdose and they're being taken to the hospital, a social worker needs to sit down with this patient and say, hey, listen, your naloxone cost X amount of money. Your ambulance costs X amount of money. The EMTs are paid this much, and just getting to the door of the ED has cost this much money. If you do not take treatment, you're going to be held responsible for this bill. And I think that implementing a system of accountability from the very beginning is going to bring drastic social change to our people.
No matter how these elections turn out in 2020, the political atmosphere is likely to remain a very contentious one.
Yeah.
So how would you, if you're elected, work with colleagues from the other party to deal with these pressing issues that we've been talking about?
Yeah. So, you know, I had a politician who ran for office many years ago. She came and saw me at my store, and she brought me one of her books. And the one thing that she said was that she admired the fact that I have such a strong personality. I stand firm with my morals and my beliefs. However, I have the ability to reach across party lines and to have discussions in a healthy manner and be able to come up with a resolution and meet in the middle. I think that the problem with our government now is the fact that we have engaged in so many partisan agendas that we're not putting Americans first. We're not putting the proper resources into place. We are continuing to argue across party lines and nobody's meeting in the middle. There's no neutrality. And I think as a gay Republican, I'm one of those people that can meet down the center of the party lines and be able to reestablish a relationship between Democrats and Republicans, because right now it's not great at all. You know, we really need to focus on what's important to Americans and what is going to, quote unquote, make America great again.
And finally, is there an issue you feel is not getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle, and how would you address it if you are elected?
You know, I think that a lot of people are jumping on the bandwagon of substance use disorder treatment, and I think that one of the things that we're not really focusing on is the fact that right now the systems that are in place are, okay, we put people into detox, it's 15 days, and then we put them in intensive outpatient therapy, which is great. You know, it's great for your white-collar working citizens. However, we're not really giving these people the opportunity to get down to the why. I've been in recovery for 5 years myself. I know what works and what does not work. I know that if you're early in recovery, that you shouldn't get into a relationship within the first 2 years. I know that your way is never really the great way of obtaining sobriety. For myself, I know that I had to humble myself and put my pride aside and do what I was told versus what I normally do, because like in the program, they talk about the actor who's always trying to rearrange the set and, you know, tell everybody what to do. And it's just the egomaniac that's running wild. And I was that egomaniac. And I know that addictive behaviors and everything that's incorporated with addiction comes with those types of behaviors. And in order to fix those behaviors, in order to be able to change your thinking, you need time. And I don't think that 15 days of detox is adequate time. We can't be throwing people back into society and with everything in their faces right off the bat. I think that it's important that we implement long-term treatment. I think that there are some amazing Christian-based rehabs that are coming into fruition right now in the state of Delaware, and they're not receiving the proper funding that they need. And I think that we need to start reaching out to those 12-step based programs and helping them out, because I myself am a direct reflection of a 12-step program, and I was able to completely change my life. And I think that those are some of the things that we really need to focus on: long-term treatment, as well as these 12-step based programs. And not just, you know, where these judges are sentencing people to their sentences, where they're, you know, being incarcerated for, not so much of a lengthy period of time. They're being released out on probation or parole, and then the stipulations of their probation is you have to go to an AA meeting. I've been there. I've done that. I know that it's very, very easy to show up to an AA meeting, sit there, not pay attention, and be like, hey, can I have a signature? And you don't get anything out of it. And the reason why is because you're not really getting down to the why. I think that needs to be a focus. We have more Americans who are dying from substance use disorder than almost anything else. You know, 88,000 people die from alcohol-related deaths. 67,000 people die from opioid-related deaths in America. That's pushing it to like 140,000. You know, that's a lot of people. You know, I think that our prison reform system needs to be changed as well when it comes to our programming. And I'm not saying like programming, like we're going to program people's minds. I'm saying like providing adequate resources to change antisocial behavior to enable pro-social behaviors so we can get these people off of the streets back into the economy. I want to get young men off of the streets and into Wall Street. If there's anybody who understands strong business acumen, it's a drug dealer. You know, and there's like this whole, there's this whole ideology, like you don't get high on your own supply. Like that's smart business acumen, whether we like to admit it or not. And these men would be strong, strong businessmen. And why not take advantage of the fact that they already have this business acumen and lead them in the right direction so they can be making money legally. They don't have to be looking over their shoulders and they don't have to worry about the police bothering them anymore. Get them off of the streets and into business suits.
That's Republican candidate for U.S. House, Matthew Morris. Our full conversation with him is available at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, we hear from the other GOP candidate for U.S. House, Lee Murphy. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our candidate conversations with the Republicans running for U.S. House, turning now to Lee Murphy. This is Murphy's second run for U.S. House. He ran for the state's lone House seat in 2018, but was narrowly defeated by Scott Walker. He also unsuccessfully ran for Newcastle County Council in 1984 and State Senate in 2000 and 2002. A reminder, the interviews you hear here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org.
So we'll ask why you decided to make another run for U.S. House. So you ran last cycle. You're trying again now. What prompted you to try again this time?
You know, Tom, sometimes in politics and running for office, sometimes the first time you don't succeed. So it takes a second time. And quite frankly, in 2018, we got in the race very late, June of 2018. We ran a great campaign for three solid months up and down the state. A lot of people didn't know me, especially in Sussex County in 2018. We did everything we possibly could in 2018. And we came up short on the primary. But right after that kind of tough loss, we thought about what we were going to do going forward, and I decided that not to give up and to make another run here in 2020. We actually announced back in June of 2019, and we've been campaigning up and down the state since June of 2019, and we are in a great position. Right now, I feel very confident. We just recently got the unanimous endorsement at the Republican convention, state convention, and it's no small feat to unify this state, at least on the Republican side, Sussex, Kent, and Newcastle. I have support in all three counties, and I have a unified Republican Party behind me. And that's so important going into this race in the fall.
I know you feel probably you're a little bit better known this time around than the last time, but are there some things that, or something that voters should know about your qualifications for this job that perhaps they wouldn't know already or know by glancing at your website or doing a Google search of you?
Well, Tom, I like to say that, you know, I'm the blue-collar candidate here, the Republican blue-collar candidate. You know, I after graduating from college, I settled here in Delaware 50 years ago. I began my career as a school teacher right here in the Catholic Diocese of Wilmington, Delaware. I've coached sports at Archmere, St. Mark's, and St. Elizabeth's. You know, I had a growing family way back. The salary for a teacher in a Catholic school was quite low in the 1970s, so I had to seek other career opportunities. My grandfather worked on the Pennsylvania Railroad for 50 years. I always loved trains growing up, so I got a job on the railroad and started as a laborer in the track gang and moved up the ladder, train dispatcher, train conductor, locomotive engineer. Went into management, had a very satisfying and fun career on the railroad for 35 years.
Let's talk about some issues.
Sure.
How well do you feel the federal government, and specifically Congress, has done in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic? And if there's still no readily available vaccine or well-established treatments for the virus by the end of this year, what would you want Congress to prioritize in an ongoing response if you're elected?
Well, I think number one, the bills that Congress has passed to help people in need and businesses. Right now, we're experiencing a bill that's in Congress. It's quite frankly being held up by the Democrats. People need help. They need financial help. Small businesses need help. The Democrats have packed these bills since COVID started with unnecessary pork. We don't need to fund the Kennedy Center. We don't need to address global warming with these bills. We need to help people in need. People have lost their jobs. People have to pay their rent. They have to pay their mortgages. Small businesses, through no fault of their own, need money. They need assistance. So to delay these bills, as the Democrats have, and my opponent has, quite frankly, over and over again, that serves no purpose. People need help. And the president recently signed these executive orders that will give people the help that they need. They will continue to have payments from the federal government so they can pay their mortgage, so they can pay groceries. It's no time to play politics right now. People need assistance. And people have lost their jobs, and through no fault of their own, and the government should make them whole going forward. Once I'm in Congress, whatever is needed for people and businesses, I will support that. I will never, ever put pork in any bill that's designed to help people in an emergency pandemic situation as we face right now.
And I want to talk a little bit more about the economic piece of it in a moment, but in terms of COVID response from Congress beyond the economy, are there things that the federal government or specifically Congress should be doing in terms of addressing the virus itself, testing, vaccines? Are there things that, is there a role for Congress in that realm to help make things better?
I think obviously Congress needs to supply the funds needed for testing. And we have tested more people in our country than any other country around the world. We need to continue to test people for the virus. That should be ongoing. We need to bring, there is research going on. Pharmaceutical companies are stepping up, and there are possible vaccines on the horizon. The Congress needs to encourage this research and support this research. It would be nice if we could bring all the research together under one roof, and whether our federal government should support that and make this a concentrated effort to find a vaccine for COVID. But we may not have a vaccine for COVID, and we have to come out of this one way or another. We need to get our economy back on track.
Okay, let's get back to the economy for a moment, because you talk specifically about kind of this immediate relief for people as the pandemic is going on. Obviously, it's already had kind of a ripple effect where even should things get better, should there be a vaccine, there's still a recession that's going to have to be worked out of. There's still high levels of unemployment. And I guess the question for you there would be then, what role can Congress play in getting the economy back on track more long-term, particularly if the pandemic kind of lingers a little bit longer into 2021, and this is a longer recovery than a shorter one?
Well, I think Congress has to, I think we have to encourage small business and business in general. I personally believe in the small business owners in this country, the people that own restaurants, the small businesses that have been ignored during this pandemic. If a Walmart or a Home Depot can open safely, I think small business could especially open safely. I think that Congress's role in that is to let small business have the latitude to safely open their businesses. They know their businesses. They know what it takes. And we've seen across America, many small businesses and small business owners really are innovative during this crisis and have opened their businesses safely and just to survive.
Let's talk a little bit about some other issues. Healthcare was certainly a major issue in the 2018 midterms, as you may well recall. There's still a lot of uncertainty about the future of the Affordable Care Act. And at the same time, there's a growing push on the progressive side of the Democratic Party for some kind of Medicare for all. What do you see as the appropriate path forward when it comes to addressing healthcare? And if it's not the ACA and it's not Medicare for all, what should it be?
Well, it's not the ACA. And I feel that the Obamacare was not a very effective solution to our nation's health care needs. This is a very complicated problem, but I really believe that it has to be not driven by the federal government. Okay, I don't have faith in the federal government in many areas to run anything, let alone billions and billions of dollars in health care. We really have to address what's needed. This has to be, I think, a private-driven solution to our health care needs in this country, where everybody has accessibility to health care. It has to be quality care, and it has to be affordable. Again, this is not a simple problem, but it needs to be addressed even during these times. I mean, people are severely challenged health-wise and also economically. So healthcare needs to, in my opinion, be driven by a private-public solution, more private than public, to fit the needs of people throughout the country, and competition among the states to drive down healthcare costs, competition in terms of our prescription drugs, people be able to get those drugs from outside our country. An example is Canada, where the drugs are less expensive for people to have access to affordable drugs. It's something that we need to address and solve in this.
Any concern if the courts do throw out Obamacare, for example, about there being a gap between that plan, which is in place, and whatever would come next, particularly in terms of things like pre-existing conditions and such? Is there any concern on your part that in the absence of something to replace Obamacare and the ACA immediately, if it does get thrown out, there would be a gap for a lot of people that would be very difficult to bridge?
Well, pre-existing conditions have to be taken into consideration, and people with pre-existing conditions have to be covered during any kind of gap, as you mentioned, from one form of healthcare to another form of healthcare. You know, the healthcare, the Democrats talk about Medicare for all, and 180 million people are happy with their healthcare, private healthcare in this country. They would lose that healthcare that they're currently happy with. But getting back to address your question, yeah, there would have to be people with pre-existing conditions have to be covered during at any time.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about racial equity. Obviously, the country has seen protests throughout the spring and summer focusing on issues surrounding racial equity. And the topics on this have kind of run the gamut from removing monuments and renaming sports teams to police reform and addressing disparities in areas like housing and education. What do you believe Congress's role is in addressing some of these issues going forward?
Well, we have had a lot of racial unrest here in our country in the past few months. As a congressman, number one, I will support our law enforcement. Many talk of defunding the police. I find that absurd, and I would vote and support police. I would vote for more funding for training and other purposes. We live in a country where law and order needs to be obeyed. We live in a country where there is a process if you want to take down a statue. We live in a country where if you want to change the law, there is a process, or even the Constitution, there is a process. What's going on in the country right now in cities like Seattle and Portland is quite disturbing to me. It makes it more important for people to stand up right now in this country. Stand up for the values, stand up for our Constitution, stand up for our law enforcement. This lawlessness cannot continue in our country. I witnessed here in Wilmington the taking down of the Caesar Rodney statue in Rodney Square, and quite frankly, that was very, very disturbing. Personally, I think the statue should still be up. To have a certain group of people demand that it be taken down, and then for our elected officials to bow down and just take it down, goes against everything I believe in.
No matter how the 2020 elections turn out, the political atmosphere is likely to remain a contentious one. How would you work with colleagues from the other party to tackle pressing issues like some of the ones we've talked about already?
Well, again, we're in a time in our country, and I can remember here in Delaware years ago where Republicans and Democrats actually worked together. That was called the Delaware Way. Well, the Delaware Way is long gone away, and that's unfortunate. It's gone away here in Delaware. It's gone away in our nation's capital. I personally, in my lifetime, have worked with people that don't see eye to eye with me, whether it be on my church parish council or my civic association or my swim club, for God's sakes. I think the majority in this people in our country, and I really believe this, that are a little bit left of center, or they're a little bit right of center, or right in the middle. We have extreme factions in this country that does not really do anyone any good. So when I go to Congress, I would like to sit down with my colleagues that are Democrat and look, we have to move ahead as a country, and we have to get things done here. And that's why, quite frankly, I want to go to Congress, is just to make life a little bit better for my grandchildren. And if I can do that, I'll be proud of that.
And finally, is there an issue you feel is not getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle, and how would you address it if you're elected?
Well, at home here, a couple things. at home here in Delaware in 2019, we had 0.0% economic growth. The prediction for 2020 was negative economic growth here in Delaware before COVID. We have to address the economic situation here in Delaware. We have to bring manufacturing jobs back to Delaware. We don't have General Motors. We don't have Chrysler anymore. We don't have DuPont Corporation to the extent that we had that years ago. We have to bring manufacturing jobs back to Delaware so people that graduate from high school and college can work here, can stay here. There's nothing for them right now. One of the first things I want to do when I go to Congress, sit down with the president, and I talk to Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas about this, is bringing drug manufacturing back from China, where it poses a threat to our national security, quite frankly. Many of us did not know it, that our drugs, life-saving drugs, are made in China. We need to bring that manufacturing back to the United States. And why not bring that manufacturing, that drug manufacturing, back here to Delaware, where we could supply our citizens with really good-paying jobs? And I will be determined to do that. And one other issue where Delaware, this is a very personal issue to me, the opioid drug crisis. We are second in the country in overdose deaths. And this is a problem that is increasingly getting worse, even with the COVID, with the shutdown. We need to address this opioid drug problem. The president has earmarked $6 billion for this. I want to bring those resources back to Delaware. On the front end, we need to invest in prevention, and on the back end, we need to invest on long-term treatment programs for those that are ready to face their addiction and turn their lives around.
That's Republican candidate for U.S. House, Lee Murphy. Our full conversation with him is available at DelawarePublic.org. Next, we wrap up the Green with a look at the Democratic primary for the 8th District House seat in the General Assembly. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. With Delaware's primary election less than a week away, our Races to Watch series looks at a key state house race in the Middletown area. Incumbent Quinn Johnson is not running in the 8th District, and Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia introduces us to the three Democrats hoping to fill that seat.
This trio of candidates did not have much time to prepare for the race since Johnson waited until the end of the legislative session to announce he would not seek another term. He leaves big shoes to fill as the former co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee. Yvette Santiago, a community leader who's worked in a variety of fields, faces off against Shariah Moore, a public servant-turned-teacher, and Matt Powell, a lawyer focused on land use and zoning. Santiago says she's lived in Middletown for 14 years and seen the town change dramatically. She notes it's become much more diverse, and as a Hispanic woman with a biracial family, she thinks she's best prepared to represent a changing city.
The diversity that I see in Middletown is the diversity I would like to see represented within our state government. And in this position for state representative, I believe it warrants someone that truly represents that diversity, not only just in ethnicity and in gender, but also in experiences. And in order to be able to truly understand and recognize issues that are impacting our most vulnerable communities and our people of color, I think it does need to be someone with that diverse background, such as myself.
Santiago considers coronavirus recovery the biggest issue currently facing the first state.
But I can tell you right now, COVID-19 is at the top of the priority. I mean, at this point, you know, our state government is doing a great job, and they're doing as much as they possibly can to try to get back to some type of normalcy. But that's top priority, is working with my colleagues in the legislature to figure out what else is needed to make sure that we're able to get back to, you know, as much as normal operations as we're used to.
Santiago's other priorities include mental health, supporting public schools, and police reform. Sharia Moore shares many of Santiago's priorities. Moore agrees that Middletown is changing, becoming more diverse, and she wants someone elected to represent that change. She believes that she is that person.
I believe my experiences as a Black woman, a mother, an educator, and a millennial, I believe those are essential due to the current makeup of who is elected to represent us in this area. I believe that Middletown is changing in its dynamics, their demographics, and it's time to elect someone that mirrors the population.
Moore lists education, healthcare, and the environment as the issues she is focused on. She says her passion for healthcare comes from personal experience. She lost her father because he was underinsured and couldn't afford the level of care needed.
I understand. No one should have to choose between putting food on their table and paying medical bills or paying their rent or over paying for their medication. So we have to do better for our residents. And this is the reason why I'm running.
Powell grew up in Middletown and has witnessed its growth throughout his lifetime. He says he's motivated by his passion for community service and Middletown.
Third generation, and you know, a lot of people see that as maybe at a disadvantage because it's status quo. But to me, and through my education and background, I want to see that this town continues to progress and to be kind of a town of opportunities, whether it be through jobs, through inclusion, because we know that this town is growing and to provide opportunities for everyone. It's not the small town that it used to be 20 years ago when there were 2,000 people. Now there's 22,000.
And seeing the town continue to develop is one of Powell's top priorities. He notes as a land use attorney, he has experience with infrastructure and dealing with growth.
You know, with my background, I see the importance and the need, especially short-term, but not only short-term, long-term, because this town is growing exponentially yearly, for the proper infrastructure to sustain long-term growth.
All three candidates agree Middletown should continue to grow quickly, and whoever represents the area should make sure development happens successfully. The winner of this primary faces Republican Dan Sidofsky in November's general election. Roman Battaglia, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Roman. And a reminder, you can find this story and all of our election coverage anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Candidate Conversations Associate Producer Kelly Reed, and Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again on another special edition of The Green, Thursday at 3 p.m.